You are listening to the Sunday morning sermon from Faith Bible Church in Sharpsburg, Georgia. You can find podcasts and other resources at www.faithbiblechurch.us.
If you would, take your Bibles, open them to, we were just in Job reading, so go one book prior to that, and you're there. Nehemiah, Esther. We have an ambitious goal. I have an ambitious goal this morning to preach the entire book of Esther this morning. Some of you are skeptical. Oh, ye of little faith. We did it in the first service, so I'm confident we can do it again and still get you out for lunch. This is where we'll be. Of course, we can't read the entire book of Esther. That would probably take just about all of our time. So we'll just pick some select portions to read, and then we'll summarize other sections as we work through the book. You can start. We'll read Esther 3, actually, in a moment to start. Robert Evans is a retired pastor who lives in Australia. If Evans fixes his gaze on a collection of particles of any magnitude, then the next time he looks at them, he can instantly tell if one of those particles is missing or not, and if one has been added to the particles. To illustrate this rare gift, imagine a pool table that has a handful of grains of salt strewn about upon it. But then extend that out and add about 1,500 more pool tables with grains of salt scattered across them. After Evans has walked around and inspected each table in the world's largest pool hall, you could then sneak one grain of salt off of any table and toss it onto another table. Upon his next stroll through the pool hall, Evans would be able to identify where you had taken the grain of salt from and where you had placed it on a different table. Evans explained to one interviewer, quote, "I just seem to have a knack for memorizing star fields. I'm not particularly good at other things. I don't remember names well." And then his wife added, "or where he puts things." Evans is the one man who can help astronomers spot the appearance of a rare phenomenon in the cosmos, namely supernova. The only way to identify the pinprick as a supernova is if you know the patch of blackness it occupies well enough to notice a change that's taken place. In fact, a galaxy of millions of stars might only boast one such supernova in 300 years. No one in history claimed bragging rights for spotting more than one of them, except for Evans. Before different computers came along to help identify these better, in around 2003, only 96 supernovas to that point were sighted and had been cataloged, 36 of which were thanks to Evans. He once went 3 years without a supernova sighting, and in that experience, he said this. He explained, "There's actually a certain value in not finding anything. It is one of those rare areas where the absence of evidence is evidence. The absence of evidence is evidence." And it's in this paradoxical statement of Evans where we find a practical guide for interpreting the book of Esther. The book of Esther seems to be godless. The name of God, any name of God, God's name is never used. And this has actually been a cause for some to question the book of Esther. Why isn't God mentioned in this book? And yet the absence of God's name in the book, in this case, is actually evidence for God's work in the book. The first suggestion that we should make when we see the absence of God's name is that the writer did this deliberately. When you're studying your Bible, it's good to often look for repetition, for when something is repeated over and over again, or a word or something, the author's trying to emphasize something. But there's also an instance where the author will sometimes not mention something intentionally in order to make you realize its absence and make the same kind of emphasis. Emphasis by absence. This is part of his literary artistry. The absence of God's name is not a problem, it is the author's method. But what is the motive then behind his method? Why write a book like this, in this way? Well, it is to teach you about the subtle and yet all-pervasive truth of providence. Providence. Providence can be defined as God's care for the creation, involving it, his preserving its existence, and meticulously guiding it to his intended ends. We could say that God's providence is his sovereignty at work, where he is king, he's the sovereign, and when he works out his sovereignty, we see that in providence, his meticulous guiding of all things to their intended ends. And this is a good word for us these days. 2020 probably has not turned out the way you expected it to turn out. And maybe it still will continue to surprise us. But the doctrine of providence gives us great encouragement that God is directing all things according to his master plan. Here's the big idea according to one preacher of the book of Esther. He summarizes it well in a memorable way. He says, the book of Esther is about the ever fascinating providence of a never slumbering God, which explains the preservation of his always fragile people. Now, what I want to do is begin with the real problem of the book, not the apparent problem of the lack of God's name, but the problem in the narrative, the potential annihilation of the Jews. We see it in chapter 3. Chapter 3 describes for us this plan of Haman to destroy the Jews. We're just going to read the first six verses to set the tone of the book and what the real issue is at stake here. So follow along as I read Esther chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. It says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Haman, one of the high officials of the king, is seeking to solve the Jewish problem. Haman's decree covers Jews everywhere. Ahasuerus' kingdom was vast, and so a decree like this against the Jews would, in effect, wipe out all of the Jews. We don't really have time to look into whether or not Haman being an Agagite relates him to the Amalekites as a potential explanation for this animosity. We don't really have time for rabbit trails on a morning we're trying to cover the whole book. You can look at that on your own. The main issue, though, is the danger of the extermination of the people of God, of Israel. And this has an impact for us. If Israel, the line of the Messiah, is wiped out, well, what does that mean? No Messiah. The seed of Abraham is gone. No hope of salvation. So Satan is at it again in history, seeking to destroy the plan of God. And yet it's within this context that we see the providence of God. We see really six lessons about the providence of God in order to provoke your praise. 6 lessons about the providence of God in order to provoke your praise. Consider first, God's providence is active before you are aware. God's providence is active before you are aware. We see this in chapters 1 and chapter 2. Let's go back now and read chapter 1, its first 9 verses. Starting in verse 1, we read, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus." Meet King Ahasuerus, one of the most powerful men alive. We also know him as Xerxes. Xerxes. This is the Xerxes who defeated the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae at great cost. His kingdom was vast. It says he reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. And he decided to throw a party, but not like any party you've ever experienced before. This is a 6-month-long party. It says in the text, 180 days he did this. Wow, 180 days of partying. And it's a wild party. There is no constraint whatsoever. And it culminates in this feast for 1 week at the end of all of this. This 1 week feast at the end of it all. And it's at that time that the king decides to invite to this feast his bride, his queen, Queen Vashti, to show off before the people. But Vashti says no. This probably wasn't a word that Ahasuerus was that familiar with. No. Who told this man no? Nobody. Well, the king's rulers thought this refusal might have a trickle-down effect and lead to some kind of feminist uprising. And so they had to do something about this. Something had to be done. Can read about that in chapter 1, verses 16 to 18. We have to make an example of her. Otherwise, women are going to disobey the king and their husbands. Now, in the grand scheme, it seems kind of like a minor incident in world history that she says no. And yet, her action would have a trickle-down effect that would put in motion God's plan to deliver his people. It would lead to the search for a new queen. We wonder, what if she hadn't said no? What if she hadn't refused? And of course, we don't know. But she did refuse. And it was one thing in a host of events that God used to deliver his people. After her refusal, the king had to save face. And so he deposes Queen Vashti. And he sets out to find a new queen. He basically starts the first Miss World pageant to find his wife. You can read about it in chapter 2, verses 1 to 8, looking for beautiful women. And there's likely, as you read the story, some immorality going on in this whole process as women are brought to the king. But ultimately, it is Esther who is taken and finds favor. Verse 8 says of chapter 2, "So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken in the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women." The text says that she was taken. We wonder in that, did she have a choice? Maybe she went into this willingly. Maybe she was taken. We're not for sure. We're not certain. And that's not really the direction that the author is taking us. What we do see the author emphasizing is the favor that Esther did find before the king. And he actually emphasizes it about three times in chapter 2. Verse 9 says, "And the young woman pleased him and won his favor." In verse 15, it says, "When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go in to the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her." And then again, we see in verse 17, but let's read 16 as well. "And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. And he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So she becomes the queen here, having found favor. It's the emphasis of the author. She's finding favor in the eyes of all the people, but especially in the eyes of the king. I mean, Disney, have they not taken hold of this? This is a great queen story, right? All the princesses here, and here's one that's incredible. But this is real. Now, she becomes queen, but the council of Mordecai, who basically raised her, she doesn't reveal that she is Jewish. She keeps that to herself. And now that the author has Esther as queen, he now turns the camera upon Mordecai. And we see in the end of chapter 2 this shift in focus. Verse 19 of chapter 2, it says, When the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So Mordecai happens to overhear a plot to assassinate Ahasuerus, to kill the king. And he just happens to be in the right place at the right time. And he hears this. And so what does he do? Well, he forwards the message on to Esther, who then forwards it on to the king. And it's investigated and, of course, found to be true. And the perpetrators are found out and they're brought to justice. But after this happens, the matter is really forgotten. It's written down, and Mordecai is forgotten. It's just this little thing the author plants early in the book. Notice that the real problem in the book doesn't appear until chapter 3 that we read in the beginning, the plot of Haman to annihilate the Jews. And yet the first two chapters set us up for what God is doing before the problem even arises. Esther being queen and Mordecai foiling this assassination attempt are mentioned in chapters 1 and 2. They seem random in the beginning of the book. And yet, they will be the main factors later in the book. The author could have just as well begun the book as we began by starting chapter 3 as chapter 1 and telling us there was this plot against the Jews, and then here's what God started to do. But that's not how he orders the book. It's like God is the grand master chess player who moves his pieces into place long before he makes his decisive move. And that's exactly what he's doing in chapters 1 and 2. God puts things in place long before anyone knows that they're even needed. Esther becomes queen. Mordecai has his name recorded in this random book and forgotten. One of my professors told the story of Ronald Reagan in his early years when, before he was president, and he decided to spend some time teaching one of his aides, Mike Deaver, how to do the Heimlich maneuver. And sometime later, months or years later, Reagan was on an airplane and he was eating peanuts and drinking a Coke. And he ended up beginning to choke on one of the peanuts. And Deavers happened to see him across the way and saw that he was in distress and ran over to him and performed the maneuver upon Reagan. And he expelled the peanut. And when he regained his composure and was able to breathe again, Reagan told Deaver, "I'm sure glad I taught you that darn thing." What's the point? Well, something was in place long before it was ever needed. And that's the lesson of chapters 1 and 2. Long before anything was ever needed, God was putting in place the pieces that needed to be in place. He was moving his pieces just the way he wanted them. What we may regard as inconsequential, God may regard as the centerpiece of his plan long before it is needed. God may be at work in your trouble long before you are in trouble, before you even know that you're in trouble. God does not become aware of your problem the same day that you become aware of your problem. In fact, God never becomes aware of anything. He knows all things because he has ordained all things. God has been at work in your situation long before you became aware that a problem even existed. And this ought to give you some relief. Give you relief when the doctor calls back after your appointment. When your boss calls you into his or her office to have a conversation about your future at the company. God's providence is active before you are aware. Secondly, God's providence, we learn next, welcomes your participation. God's providence welcomes your participation. We see this in chapter 3 to chapter 5, verse 8. Now, we read part of chapter 3, and that's what introduces us up to the plan to annihilate the Jews. Mordecai then tells Esther that she needs to do something about this, and he seeks to get word to Esther of what's happening and what that she needs to act. And so pick it up in chapter 4, verse 8. It says, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. Mordecai has a plan, but it is a risky plan. And Esther seems to be somewhat apprehensive and fearful as she informs Mordecai of the stakes. See, you couldn't just walk in to have an audience with the king, even as the queen. She's saying, you know the law, Mordecai. If anyone comes in, even me, without being invited before that, it's certain death unless the king decides to override that. I don't have any assurances that the king will do that. In fact, the king hasn't seen me for 30 days. Maybe I'm on the out here. And so, what will she do? Well, Mordecai sends back word to her to challenge her. Look at verse 12. He told Mordecai what Esther had said. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than any other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." It's in these words that we see really an admonition from Mordecai, a conviction that he has, and an invitation that he gives to Esther. Now this is probably the most famous verse in Esther. But it almost seems like the author is going out of his way to avoid naming God in all of this. I mean, deliverance will come from somewhere else. I mean, he's being intentional here to avoid that for his purpose, to highlight the providence of God. Now, after this, what is Esther's response? How does she respond? Well, verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. So they have this back and forth, you know, passing messages to each other. Verse 16, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. The author, you just love the author as he just builds the suspense for us, and he does this throughout the book of what's going to happen next. So we pick it up in verse 2. "And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight." Once again, "and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, 'What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request?' 'It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom.' And Esther said, 'If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king.' Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked.' So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, 'What is your wish? It will be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled.'" Here it is. I mean, she's got the opportunity. It's right in her lap. She could just say it right now. "It's Haman! Get him!" But look at what the text says. Verse 7, "Then Esther answered, 'My wish and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said.'" What? I mean, we are at the feast. This is the feast you prepared. You want to prepare another feast? It's like, it was a great time hanging out. Let's do this again. And then I'll tell you, what is going on here? Why this delay? And we don't actually know exactly why there's a delay, but it all fits in the plan. And so we're like, you missed it. You missed your opportunity. And here's where you see all of the suspense in this. Suspense. But here's the point I want to draw out for us, that God is at work at all times, but he often uses human instruments to accomplish his purposes. God may work apart from your efforts, but he often loves to use your efforts just as he loved to use the work of Esther here to deliver his people. And sometimes it may involve great anguish for you as you work to accomplish the purpose of God. But God uses us. He incorporates our freedom into his plan. Sometimes providence does come with fireworks, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes God moves his people to act in a spectacular way. And sometimes God acts to move his people in a very simple way. How does God care for someone who's sick in the church? Well, he could do it in a lot of ways. But maybe he moves the heart of a young person in the church to go mow their lawn, buy them some groceries. Is that not an example of God's providence at work, even if yet less spectacular? Of course it is. So you have to remember that God's providence doesn't wipe out your participation, but it welcomes it. It welcomes your participation. So we see that God's providence is active before you're aware, welcomes your participation. Notice third, God's providence is multifaceted. God's providence is multifaceted. Let's pick it up in verse 9 of chapter 5 through chapter 6, verse 3. Esther had begun her scheme. The king had accepted her, but Esther didn't say what was the issue specifically. Now, the king had to know this issue was massive. How could we possibly know that? Well, she comes in and barges in to have a presence with the king. The king knows the law. Likely, he's actually put people to death for doing that. So it must be something huge on her mind. But here's where a new tension comes. In between the two banquets, a fresh emergency arises. In chapter 5, verses 9 to 14, it's the issue of Mordecai. Look there, chapter 5, verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." The idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So Haman leaves the first banquet with Queen Esther, and on his way back home, he runs into Mordecai. And once again, Mordecai doesn't bow down to him for whatever reason. We don't actually know the motivation of Mordecai. But this infuriates Haman. He goes home and begins to recount to his family all of his splendor, his riches. The king is honoring him. He has such a great place, all these sons. And yet he can't enjoy it. The fly in the ointment for Haman is Mordecai being alive. As long as Mordecai's heart beats, Haman cannot enjoy all that he has. It's eating him up inside. And so his wife comes up with a great plan along with their family. "Well, build a gallows. And you're in the king's favor. I mean, goodness, the queen invited only you. So they'll listen to you and just have Mordecai hanged in the morning before the feast. Then you can go to the feast and enjoy yourself because that issue will be done and you'll have full ability to take delight." Now, do you see what's happening here? This is a subplot in the book. The issue is not just the fate of the Jews, but now the fate of a Jew, one particular Jew, Mordecai. And in order to feel the tension of all this, you need to see the timing of all of this. This preceded Esther's pleading for her people at the second banquet. What does that mean? Well, there's no one to plead for Mordecai. Esther and Mordecai are probably unaware at this point of the plot against Mordecai. She hasn't said anything. She had her opportunity, but she let it pass. She delayed it. And now a new issue comes. And before Esther will be able to tell the king of her request to save her people, of which Mordecai is one of them, Mordecai is going to get hung before that. It's going to happen in the morning. What's going to happen? How will Mordecai be delivered? This is the tension. But God is not limited by our unavailability. He's never limited by our unavailability. There's no Esther here to help. But he doesn't always need our assistance. Yes, God may use human instrumentality, like in chapter 4, verse 14, to accomplish his purposes. But he also might just act by himself and keep the king awake at night, as in chapter 6, verse 1. For the Jews, he uses human instruments. For a Jew, he just acts himself. Look at verses 1 to 3 of chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles. And they were read before the king, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young man who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And so we see God working unilaterally. He works in a different way here. Let's not make God boring. God doesn't have to act in the same way every single time. He's not locked into doing the same thing in the same way in every circumstance. In some circumstances, he might move Queen Esther or move Mordecai to motivate Queen Esther to go to the king and act. But he may not choose to do that, and he may choose just to act, because no one knows about this problem that's about to take place. And so he says, "We'll fix that. Little insomnia. All right, boom." He doesn't always have to do things the same way. I mean, a great example in Acts 16, look at the three conversions, all very different. You have the Philippian jailer, Lydia, and the demon-possessed woman, all members of the same congregation eventually, but all saved by grace through faith in the Messiah, and yet in very different ways. We see the variety of this God. One writer said, God's providence is kaleidoscopic. It's kaleidoscopic. It's multi-layered. It's multifaceted. But notice also the precision and humor in chapter 6. And I think we can squeeze another point in here. In chapter 6, and call it God's providence provokes your praise. Really, this is the intent of the whole book, is to provoke your praise. But here we see it especially in chapter 6, verses 1 to 11. We read those first three verses and were reminded that it just so happened. It just so happened that he couldn't sleep for whatever reason. He had too much coffee. You know, we don't know. It just so happened that he asked for that book to be brought. He didn't have a TV. He didn't have Netflix. And it just so happened that he read the part about Mordecai's deed. I mean, why was it there that the book opened? And he just happened to inquire if something had been done for Mordecai. For whatever reason, he just thought he'd ask. And it just so happened that Haman was plotting Mordecai's death at just this time. This is just a little detail, but it's an important one. King can't sleep. He has the equivalent of the phone book brought to him. If you know what that is, young people, it's a book of phone numbers, people's names and addresses. Yeah. It's not opening your phone and going through your contacts. Just a detail, but an important one. And there's humor here. There's humor here. As the reader of this book, you're omniscient. You're omniscient. You know what Haman doesn't know, and you know what Ahasuerus doesn't know. You know all the details. And so as you read it, the author is saying, you have the reader's edge. You're omniscient. And so you're able to appreciate this. I mean, look at how amusing this is. Pick it up in verse 5. And the king's young men told him, Haman is here, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And who is the king thinking of? Mordecai. And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? You can almost imagine there's this thought bubble coming out of his head. And then he just goes over the top here. Verse 7, and Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. I mean, Haman thinks he's got it coming to him. He's like, all right, here's my wish list. And he just gives it all. But we have the reader's edge. And so we just can't help but laugh and chuckle at this. And then we read verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, and leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. I mean, how could he say that with like full gusto? I mean, oh, it must have just eaten him up inside. I mean, what was his other option though? He couldn't disobey the king in this. And so we just see the humor in this. If you're an Israelite, you're on the floor laughing as you read this. He walks right into it. And the timing of all of this is just so perfect. That's what's so great about this book. And it makes us say, isn't this God so fascinating? Isn't this God so delightful? What ease that he turns his enemies' plans around and right around on their heads. The point is to get you to say with Micah, who is a God like you? And this isn't just a descriptive passage. It is meant to be doxological. This is meant to lead you into praise and worship of this God. The author doesn't want you to just make observations of the text, but to adore this God. We shouldn't just study the doctrine of providence, but worship the God who exercises providence. And so we see that providence provokes your praise. You're just like, wow, what a God. This is my God. Notice next, God's providence also guarantees the preservation of his people. God's providence guarantees the preservation of his people. In chapter 7, or the last verse of chapter 6, this is when they were yet talking with him. The king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Now, there's not enough time for Haman to flee town. You gotta go. And Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. And Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish. and my people for my request. For we have been sold, and I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent. For our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he? Who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. For he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. No kidding. Verse 8, and the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. I mean, you could just see this in a movie. The black cover goes over his face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." And the king said, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Haman is killed. Mordecai is honored. And the Jews are able to defend themselves and fight and are ultimately saved from their enemies. If you were to read the rest of 8 and 9, you'd see that. I want to point out, though, a key theme that keeps coming up in these last chapters and has already come up prior to this in the book. This idea of favor. Favor in the eyes of the people. Verse 3 of chapter 7, we read, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request." In chapter 8, verse 5, we read, if I please the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes," all this language piled up, favor, pleasing. In chapter 9, verse 2, it says, "The fear of them had fallen on all peoples." And then in chapter 9, verse 3, "The fear of Mordecai had fallen on them." Chapter 9, verse 13, she says, "If it please the king," if it please the king, this emphasis on being pleasing and having favor. God had worked in the heart of the king and in the hearts of the people to preserve his people. He was moving their hearts to grant them favor so that they might be delivered. And consider in this that God's providence not only impacts nations, big groups of people, but individuals. It impacts Mordecai. It also affects the Jews as a whole. The book of Esther is about the preservation of the Jews and one particular Jew. This is how God preserves you if you're his child. He does it through his often silent and yet precise providence. God can work in the hearts of other people to change their direction and move them to grant favor. And finally, we can observe that God's providence should be celebrated. God's providence should be celebrated. Chapter 9, verse 20, to the end of the book, in chapter 10, we see this celebration that's instituted as a result of the Jews' deliverance, this celebration of Purim. And there's a reference to poor, or what are known as lots, in verse 24. Look at verse 23. It says, So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is, cast lots to crush and to destroy them. Lots are like dice. And Haman, it was using them to devise a plan against the Jews. But Haman didn't really account for the fact that Yahweh controls the dice. He controls the lot. Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot is cast into the lap, and its every decision is from Yahweh. Every roll of the dice in Vegas is determined. There's no such thing as luck. God's providence rules over everything, even the casting of lots. God's providence is meticulous, down to the casting of dice. Nothing is random. All is governed by the providence of God. So what did the people do? Well, they took that which was used to plot against them, Pur, and they turned it into a celebration, Purim, of God's providence. And we ought to do the same in our lives as we consider God's providence working itself out in our lives. We don't need to celebrate the Feast of Purim, but we can recognize God's hand in our lives and celebrate that, rejoice in that as we look back. See, the purpose of Esther is not so much to get you to do something. There's no commands here. It's to get you to realize something. It's to get you to realize something. As we said and quoted before, it's to get you to realize the ever-fascinating providence of a never-slumbering God that explains the preservation of his always fragile people. God preserves his people through providence by protecting the line of the Messiah, but also by promoting our perseverance. It would be God's providence as well that would orchestrate the events leading to the crucifixion of the Messiah so that it would happen just as God had planned, to accomplish all the purposes that God had. And this is why in Acts chapter 4, we read in verse 27, for truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Your hand, that's providence. Your providence and your plan had predetermined to take place, even in the death of Jesus, for the forgiveness of the sins of those who would believe. Just like the book of Esther, when we look at the world, it can seem at times like God is absent, like God isn't present. And yet when we view life through the lens of providence, we can see him at work. We can see his fingerprints everywhere. Like an FBI agent who goes into a crime scene with a black light to find the fingerprints. If you approach the book of Esther with the black light of providence, you will see God's fingerprints everywhere. And you'll see the intent of the author. In the chess world, it became known as the game of the century. On October 17th, 1956, the grandmaster, Donald Byrne, was playing a highly publicized match against a 13-year-old boy named Bobby Fischer. Fischer had already become somewhat of a chess prodigy, but no one knew that he would go on to be regarded as the greatest chess player of all time. But the epic match against Byrne was a sign of wonders to come. The shock of the upset was amplified by the way that the game began. Young Bobby Fischer seemed to make a series of clumsy mistakes early on. He lost his knight in the 11th move, forfeited dominance of the center, put his pieces in harm's way, and in move 17, Fischer opted to sacrifice his queen. Said all the chess people. By any standards, this was considered a disastrous foible, an irrevocable mistake. But it was this unexpected move that made the game so famous. It was all part of Fischer's master plan. In fact, experts can now analyze the game and see that every single piece had been moved into perfect position at the right time in the game. And his choices were components of an intricate and complicated plot that would lead to a forced checkmate and a stunning victory. The beauty and art of the strategy could only be appreciated after the whole game had been played. So no one after that ever smirked at the boy's mistakes. Fisher's style was no longer dismissed as unconventional. It was hailed as ingenious. And one day, God's plans will no longer be dismissed as unconventional or questioned, but they will as well be hailed as ingenious. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word and this word highlighting your providence in the book of Esther. What a word we need these days. Lord, give us comfort, help, encouragement, knowing that you are ruling all things. You are directing our lives according to your intended outcome. Lord, we pray that you would even work in your providential way to awaken sinners to their need of you, draw them to yourself. And Lord, help us to trust you even in days when we don't see exactly the purposes that you are accomplishing. Help us to just rest that you are working, that you are bringing all things to your intended purpose. We worship you, Lord. We stand in awe of you. We praise you as we are confronted with this doctrine in your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.